It's Labor Day in America, and in lieu of our daily local news segment, we'll be airing two interviews about the state of labor in Indiana. I'm WFHB News Director Wes Martin, and in our first interview, I speak with Andrew Bradley, a senior policy analyst for the Indiana Institute for Working Families, about so-called right-to-work legislation and the labor market across the state. Following that interview, we'll be hearing from Paul Napier, the Indianapolis organizer for Service Employees International Local 1, also about right-to-work legislation and what the battle over the labor movement looks like in Indiana. Thank you for listening.
My name is Andrew Bradley. I'm Senior Policy Analyst for the Indiana Institute for Working Families.
And Mr. Bradley, what is the state of labor and labor market in Indiana, particularly with comparison to surrounding states?
Sure, thank you. Well, so this Labor Day, Hoosiers are back on the job in record numbers. The state only needs a little less than 76,000 more jobs to get to its pre-recession employment rate. But the problem is that our hard work is less likely to be protected by union coverage, and Hoosiers' pay keeps slipping compared to our neighbors. So this year, only 11.4% of Hoosier workers have union coverage. That's down from 22.6% in 1989. About a third of our public sector workers are covered by unions, even after the years of attack by right to work. About a third of Indiana's public sector workers are covered by unions, even after years of attack by so-called right to work and other labor laws. But a mere 8.5% in our private sector have union coverage. The problem with that is that Indiana now has the lowest union coverage of any of our neighbors, including Kentucky. And the issue is that a new report by the Economic Policy Institute has found that unions provide one of the best guarantees for high-quality, high-wage jobs, including paid family leave, paid sick time, fair schedules. Unions have raised wages and standards for members and non-members alike, and they decrease some gender and racial wage gaps. So that's the issue with Indiana being the lowest among all of our neighbors to have union coverage.
Why is there such a disparate enrollment between public sector workers in unions and labor organizations as opposed to private sector?
Well, one thing is there's a historic trend of public sector workers being recognized for their right to be able to stand together and have their voices heard. Usually public sector wants to be seen as a model employer and is more subject to some pressures to be able to do the right thing. Part of the issue is that there has been more of an attack on the rights of private sector workers to be able to have their voices heard. And we've seen that in laws like Indiana's so-called right-to-work law. And in 2015, we took away the common construction wage protection.
And could you talk a little bit more about what right-to-work legislation is? It's been implemented in a number of states. When was it implemented in Indiana? And also, what does that mean, or what are the repercussions of that?
Sure. So the so-called right-to-work law came to Indiana in 2012, and it's not a new concept. It was in the South and some other states for many years. Indiana was one of the first Midwestern states to see this law come into effect. The general idea is that while an occupation or a company may be covered by union protection, it would allow free riders to opt out of being able to pay their dues for that protection that they receive. And so as you can imagine, when people opt out and choose to become free riders, that kind of weakens the resources for collective bargaining.
And could you explain to our listeners what exactly a free rider is in terms of workplace union and labor membership?
So a free rider is a term of somebody, if you can imagine, like a bus. If you hop on and you're hanging on the back, well, you're getting a ride for free, but you're not chipping in for filling the tires and keeping gas in the tank. So in terms of collective bargaining, that means that you are getting the benefits in terms of the paid family and medical leave, greater health insurance, fair scheduling, protections against unfair firing, but you're not chipping in for the costs of that collective bargaining.
And it's my understanding this has been implemented in several other states. What were some of the repercussions for implementing so-called right-to-work legislation?
Well, a repercussion that we've seen is that continued decrease in union coverage in Indiana and other states. But something that's interesting is that when you compare that against median wages, Indiana's median wages have continued a downward decrease. We're now also the lowest paid of all of our neighbor states, including Kentucky. States that don't have right to work, even when you control for cost of living and region, have a 3% and more premium in median income.
Has Indiana always had lower pay than its neighboring states?
If you look long term, Indiana was the lower amongst our neighbors, except for Kentucky, into the 90s. And then we kind of shot up to join our peers in the Midwest, and we were kind of riding high there for a while. But since the recession, we've dropped back down with our median wages, and now we're even below Kentucky, and our wages really resemble more of the South than they do the Midwest. And that's something that the Institute's going to be exploring more in depth in an upcoming Status of Working Families report.
What does it mean that Indiana has the lowest union coverage among its neighbors, and what does that mean for labor in the state?
So what it means is that, you know, simply we are, the average Hoosier off the street is less likely to have a union contract and to have the coverage of those protections to job quality and wages and labor rights than would any of our neighbors.
And you had mentioned that labor and union participation helped close gender and racial wage gaps. So is it fair to assume that lower labor rates and labor participation and unionization rates, that would then translate to an increase in those gender and racial wage gaps?
I think that's a fair assumption, and I think that's an area that's ripe for study in Indiana. Frankly, that's something that I'm calling for with this new the results of this new report. Is I think Indiana's policymakers should take a long, hard look at what's been the results of so-called right to work and other anti-labor laws that have passed in the recent years. You know, have we seen any income disparities increase or decrease, especially compared to our peer states who haven't been as aggressively anti-worker with their laws?
One thing that is constantly said about Indiana, particularly by Vice President Mike Pence and former Governor Mike Pence, is that our unemployment rate remains below the national average. It sounds like, or at least they would like to make the case that, yes, passing right-to-work legislation may have led to, certain wage losses or losses in collective bargaining rights, but it has increased employment. And what would be, or what are some of the arguments, I guess, behind that perspective?
I think that's something that definitely deserves more study. What are the long-term employment rates going back well before right to work and other laws, and what are we looking at now? An interesting data point is that for the average family with children in Indiana, basic costs have gone up by 60% over the past decade, but incomes have only gone up 9%. So Hoosiers are working more, but they're paying more for basic costs, and they don't have as much income gain to show for it. And also we're seeing generationally the types of families that may have had a good, solid, blue-collar manufacturing job a decade or two ago, now their kids who are going into the workforce may have similar types of jobs that don't pay nearly as well, or they're now forced into low-wage service-type work, and they're not seeing the type of wage and job quality benefits that previous generations enjoyed. And I think that is definitely something that Indiana should take a long, hard look at and see if our labor policies are paying off the way that we think that they would have.
Could you expect part of that to be due to kind of a decreased investment in labor force education and training high-skilled labor as opposed to kind of doubling down on low-skill labor?
Well, I think that it's definitely true that there is increased demand for skilled labor, especially in the middle skill area between a high school diploma and a four-year degree. So while those demands keep increasing, our output of those who have that requisite training has remained pretty flat. So there is a skills gap in terms of the educational attainment levels. But meanwhile, the types of jobs that people are getting into, there's, you know, whether they have that education and training or not, they're less likely to have the collective bargaining and union coverage and labor standards protection once they get out on the other end. So we may be producing more higher skilled jobs, but the workers may have less voice in being able to stand together and have high quality jobs.
And what do some of those jobs look like? You said between a high school diploma and a four-year degree. What would be an example for a couple of those?
A classic example of a middle skill job is a registered nurse. Another one are electricians and plumbers and mechanics and all those type of jobs that you can't outsource because we need them in our communities. And the demand keeps increasing.
So the demand in the state keeps increasing, but we are turning out fewer and fewer. Is that the case, that we're turning out fewer of these kind of middle-of-the-road technical?
Well, I guess it's closer to say that the production is flat. Right now, we have 58% of Indiana's projected jobs are middle skill, but only 47% of Hoosiers currently have those. And that 47% is what stayed flat over the past 4 years or so.
So in theory, wouldn't that increase the rate of pay in order to in order for companies to maintain a competitive edge and be able to fulfill all of these positions? Wouldn't that mean that since the supply has remained stable but the demand has gone up, wouldn't that mean that these middle-skilled technicians and nurses would end up being paid more, or does that not necessarily translate?
You would think, you know, we hear about Econ 101 says that when the supply is low, that the demand will increase and that pay should increase. But what we've seen in Indiana is that the pay hasn't kept up. And so I think part of the solution there is that we have a policy environment that rewards and even may encourage low-road, low-pay, low-skilled jobs. And so I think as a state, that's one thing that we can do is we can start encouraging and creating incentives for higher pay, higher quality jobs.
What would some of those incentives look like?
I think we could look in terms of the way that we are doing economic development incentives, make it loud and clear that here in Indiana, we're back to work, but what we need are higher quality, higher paid jobs. That will help create an environment where we can have a higher skilled workforce, and then eventually we'll see that reflected in a higher rate of pay.
Mr. Radley, is there anything that I have failed to ask or anything that you think our listeners really need to be made aware of with regards to the status of labor in Indiana?
I guess I would say that, you know, when we're looking back at some of these attacks on labor standards, if there are benefits to undercutting Indiana's labor standards, they're not showing up in our average Hoosier paychecks and even in employers' ability to find a skilled workforce. So why keep them? I encourage Hoosiers to contact your state legislators, ask them to sponsor a study on the return on investment of Indiana's so-called right-to-work law and other attacks on labor standards, because any laws that get in the way of Hoosiers standing together for higher wages and job quality should be terminated before the next Labor Day comes around.
Just to piggyback off of that point, Mr. Bradley, is it possible that we just haven't seen enough time go by in order to see some of the benefits of right-to-work legislation? And it's my understanding that the GOP would at least say that we've seen those benefits in increased employment and decreased unemployment.
I would say that, you know, Hoosier families can't wait longer to see increased pay. And we need, as working families, to be able to see that return on investment include higher wages and higher benefits so that our families and our children can be confident in our future moving forward.
Mr. Bradley, thank you so much for speaking with us. I really appreciate it.
All right. Well, I've been a fan of WFHB for now it's many years, and I like to tune in from time to time.
That was Andrew Bradley, Senior Policy Analyst for the Indiana Institute for Working Families. Next, we'll hear from Paul Napier, the Indianapolis organizer for Service Employees International, Local 1.
The overwhelming problem in Indianapolis in the labor market is the dearth of low-paying service sector jobs. I do think that that's sort of linked with the loss of manufacturing jobs, which has been an ongoing problem. I imagine Andrew probably touched on that aspect of it a fair amount. But what we're seeing now is that as our economy is recovering, more and more of those higher-paying union jobs are being replaced by lower-paying service jobs. In Indianapolis, that could be work like we cover, janitorial work, hotel housekeepers, retail work. But those jobs that are replacing them are overwhelmingly lower paid and with fewer benefits and fewer rights on the job in general than what workers would have had in years past with our manufacturing sector. And the result of this is that we have one of the highest poverty rates in the country. 21% of folks in Indianapolis are living below the poverty level. That number is considerably worse for people of color, for children. It's in the 30% range. And so you have people working multiple jobs, trying to support themselves, but they're working a lot of part-time work. They don't have benefits, so they're getting sicker. They're spending less and less time with their families. And we're seeing, you know, degradation in our communities that is caused by this problem of low-wage work. So I think that's overwhelmingly the number one problem that I see in Indianapolis is low-wage service sector work. Workers that are making $11 an hour, $10 an hour, minimum wage $7.25, $8 an hour. That's such a common occurrence for these so-called new jobs that are coming into our state. And our goal in Local One is to address this by organizing workers and giving them a path out of poverty through collective bargaining, through direct political action to raise those wages from, you know, the $8 and $9 range up into the teens.
And Mr. Napier, do you directly attribute these kind of lower paying jobs? Would you directly attribute those to the passage of right to work legislation in the state back in 2012?
So I don't necessarily think that there's a direct link to those jobs per se being lower paid as a result of right to work. But what it does is it's yet another obstacle for workers who overwhelmingly would support organizing and would overwhelmingly support a path to higher wages and benefits. But it makes it harder to organize because we have fewer and fewer resources to do so. And it takes the economic risk that we're engaging in these types of labor fights, and it puts it on the workers. So when you have someone who's making $8.50 an hour or $9 an hour, they can, on an intellectual level, understand that paying dues and being a member of a union is going to help get them out of the situation that they're in. But when they're facing a decision about, you know, falling behind on their rents, not having money to put food on the table, and they're looking at ways that they can cut back, it's very tempting for them to say, hey, I'm going to stop paying unions, which means that they have less power to be able to take on the powerful corporate interests that are maintaining the system of low pay work.
Vice President Pence has said repeatedly that Indiana has a lower unemployment rate than the national average. And a lot of that, the Republican base would end up looking at right-to-work legislation and saying, well, that's exactly why, is we've made it easier for employers to hire people in Indiana. And what would be your response to that argument that right-to-work actually increases employment?
Frankly, I think that's bull****. I think it's playing funny numbers games with people's lives. I think that, when we look at people that are just counting jobs, they're not looking at what people's quality of life is like. And then by not looking at what people's quality of life looks like, they can then justify actions that further enrich the already wealthy, the already powerful. So, you know, we saw the repeal of the common construction wage. So, you know, we're driving down wages and we can brag about there being more jobs, but you have more people in poverty. So who's that actually helping? I think that this state needs to take serious action to address the fact that we have so many people that are working really, really hard, working multiple jobs, and it's still not cutting it. They're still facing eviction from their homes. They're still facing challenges on putting food on the table. You know, what are we doing to address the consequences of poverty, but what are we doing to offer people a path out of that themselves so that they don't have to depend on public aid to support their families, that the honest work that they're putting in is enough for them to be able to provide for their basic needs and maybe even thin some a little bit.
And Mr. Napier, do you have any additional comments or anything you think our listeners need to know, in particular relating to Southern Indiana, with regards to labor issues and the status of labor in the state of Indiana?
Well, I think in general, I think that listeners, I'm sure many of your listeners are feeling the pinch that these policies have caused. I think it's going to resonate with a lot of folks. I want folks that are feeling that to feel empowered to stand up to those interests, because there's more of us than them. And we have the power to fight back. We have the power to change those circumstances. We're doing it in Indianapolis, where we're seeing service sector unionism is rising, and it's putting us in a position to make significant gains, both in wages and benefits for folks. And I think whether we're, you know, where I am here in Indianapolis, or whether you're in Southern Indiana or any other part of the state, you know, that we're not being handed a better life. We're being put in a situation where, if we want to see more money coming into our bank accounts, we're going to have to stand up and fight for it. So I would want viewers to, whether they're service workers or other low-paid workers, or whether they're folks that just share a concern about that, to, you know, be willing to go out there and do the hard work to organize, to hold our elected officials accountable for the policies that they're implementing. And don't believe these talking points that they have about, oh, well, we're creating jobs. Demand to know what kind of jobs are being created. Demand to know what those people are living like. And I think when people take a look at that, they're going to be horrified by what's happening in our state. And we'll be compelled to stand up to those corporate interests that are causing this in the first place and demand something better.
And Mr. Napier, it sounds like you would say that the participation in labor unions and in organized workers is increasing.
I feel that way in our sector. You know, we've seen service workers forming unions since 2015. We organize about 500 security workers in Indianapolis. We're seeing workers in food service organizing. A partner union of ours, Unite Here Local 23, has organized food service workers in new locations throughout this year. And so, yeah, so we're seeing folks that are saying enough is enough, and they're forming unions, and they're winning. They're winning wage increases out of that. And I anticipate in the next year, the next 2 years, that we're going to continue to see that trend towards unionization continue in our sectors, because that's our organization's main priority is growth and giving workers an opportunity to participate in collective bargaining and transform their lives. So, yeah, I think that it'll continue. We've definitely seen it growing over the past couple of years, and I think that pattern's going to continue going into the future.
And you had said that it sounds like a growth in wages was one of the bigger areas of your primary concern. Does that extend to benefits, or is this kind of a one battle at a time, or is it growth in wages in lieu of benefits?
No, it can't be one or the other, because if you just fight for wages, that's going to help people. It's definitely going to put money in their pockets. But, you know, when people have a health emergency and they don't have health insurance, the likelihood of us being able to bargain a contract just purely on wages alone that can cover the types of costs that people face with a health emergency, it's not going to cut it. They need these benefits too. So they need health insurance. They need benefits like paid time off. You know, so many workers don't get the opportunity to have paid time off, whether that's for vacation, whether they're sick. It's hard for them to be able to take time off to deal with that. So we organize for and bargain for all of these things. And I don't think it's a one or the other. I think they're all part of the package that leads towards creating the types of jobs that people really need to survive. If we take a, you know, one thing at a time approach, I think it will take too long for us to get there for folks.
Mr. Napier, my last question, unless you have anything else to add, is that it sounds Indiana seems like one of the more difficult states to be a labor rights activist in, or to participate on behalf of a union. Is there any luck in this fight, or is this mostly an uphill battle?
It's always an uphill battle, whatever state you're in. The interests that want to maintain the status quo are extremely powerful. They have tons and tons of money, and they're willing to spend that money to make sure that they maintain their power within our economy. So anything that we do as a labor movement to disrupt that is going to be a challenge, regardless to where we are. I think there are some unique challenges in Indiana, but I also think that we have a state of hardworking people who are prepared and ready to engage in the types of organizing campaigns that it takes to win. So I'm personally very optimistic about organizing labor in Indiana. I know we recently, I think Andrew mentioned he sent you the Indy Star article that about our campaign recently. But, you know, we just took on a large property management company based out of state who decided to change and do business with a non-union company for their janitorial services. They made that decision because they felt like they could save money on the backs of the workers. It caused all of our folks to lose their jobs and the progress that we've made with them. But with those workers, we engaged in a 6-month-long struggle to get those jobs back. And just last week, all of those folks had the opportunity to return back to work. So, you know, it's fights like those where we can see that we can take on powerful interests and working people can win, even when traditional assumptions about our state would assume that that's impossible. I think that gives me a lot of hope going forward in the future for things like our janitorial contract negotiations next year, where we're going to be setting the new standard for janitorial work in the state. It gives me a lot of optimism that I think we'll be in a much better situation by the end of 2018 than where we're at right now. And I think people across the state should share in that optimism and that hope.
And is there anything coming up for Local One, or do you have any plans for Labor Day?
So this Labor Day, we're going to be working with the Marion County Democratic Party at the Indy Labor Fest to register voters. We know that a big part of our path towards prosperity is being able to build the kind of political power that it takes to change policy. And if we're going to do that, we have to build a broader electorate. We've got to get people excited about voting. And I think starting with the Indy Labor Fest is a good place to do that. So our members are going to be out talking to anybody around the Labor Fest, getting them signed up, registered to vote so that they can participate in the elections next year.
That was Paul Napier, the Indianapolis organizer for Service Employees International Local One. Thanks for listening to this Daily Local News Labor Day special here on WFHB.